Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, my video version of a Reddit AMA. I wanted to get a couple plugs out of the way right away before we get into the questions. First off, I have now finished the three-part series with Larissa Smith and the DeWolves. And that last one particularly is an extremely powerful and somewhat disturbing video in terms of what happened to her and the whole story. And I really hope that you guys will check that out. And also, I have not been a person who has particularly said or asked for a lot of shares and likes and that sort of thing. But I think that story really deserves to be shared far and wide. And I hope that you will not only watch that series and see all the detail and work that went into giving the entire story, but also that story gets out far and wide. So check it out. I've also got, I think, I've really been doing a lot of work on my podcast to put some quality content out there that is not necessarily always Scientology related, but I still think is informative, educational, and entertaining. And I hope that you guys will also check out my podcast. That's the Sensibly Speaking podcast, and it's on my YouTube channel. And also, of course, as a podcast available on iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play. And anyway, those are my little plugs. As I'm talking to you now, as you're watching this, I am in Los Angeles speaking at a conference for the International Cultic Studies Association on cult recovery. Was the subject of the conference. I'm at the Center for Inquiry in Los Angeles. And that was actually where I went out to LA and did my book signing. And I hope to maybe see some of you there. So I've plugged it on social media, so hopefully you guys will get the word on that. Now, let's get on with your questions. Jeff Smith, question. To prepare for your new interviews, I was watching your original interview with Tim DeWall, and y'all talked about his case being messed up with 37 PC folders and having to pay for more auditing to correct it, and how that is common. As a never-in, exactly what does all that mean? How do they mess up your case to prevent progress up the bridge? Is it part of the scam to get more money? In an earlier Q&A, I remember talking about case supervisors, and I can't remember right off the top of my head which number that was, but I will look it up and put a link to it below so that you can see what I said about how Scientology auditing is directed by a third person. You have an auditor and you have the pre-clear, right? And that's in the auditing room, that's the setup. But there's a third person external to all that called the case supervisor who directs what's done with the case. And it's all personal judgment, okay? So when a person comes into Scientology and is going to want to go up the bridge to total freedom, right? They're going to get all this auditing, and the auditing is directed by the basic program or the basic series of actions that are done are what you see on this grade chart or this bridge to total freedom. And you can look that up. It's all those steps that you take all the way up to the upper OT levels. But it starts with the purification rundown and objective auditing, and then there's a thing called ARC straight wire and the grades 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then there is New Era Dianetics. And once you finish with New Era Dianetics, you're supposed to be clear, or most people are. And if you're not, there's an alternate route of steps that you do in order to become clear. And by the time then you achieve the state of clear, and then you're ready to do those OT levels. And all of these steps are not simple little actions. They consist of many, many different kinds of auditing processes or procedures with different questions that are asked in different ways, different series of questions that are asked, and each process has its own end result or what's called in Scientology an end phenomena. So if you go into an auditing session, let's say on Tuesday, you go into the org and you've paid for 12 and a half hours of auditing, well, it might take 2 or 3 hours to complete one process, which is just one part of a whole series of processes just to finish that one step on the grade chart. Let's say ARC straight wire, which is just a fancy name for a bunch of memory processes, a bunch of things that are done in order to get a person remembering things better and being able to recall with various perceptions, sight, smell, sound, you know, things like that. And ARC straight wire sort of gets you tuned up to be able to do the grades. Grade zero addresses communication. Grade one addresses problems and so on. So these, so within ARC straight wire or within grade zero, you have, you know, 10, 20, 30 processes that might be run. And each one of those processes could take 10 minutes, 15 minutes, or a process could take, depending on the person and their experiences and whatnot, 3 hours to do, right? You could spend your entire night on one process. You could spend multiple days on one process. So that's how it's sort of broken down, okay? So you can see why it's hours and hours and hours and hours of work, right? These intensives are sold in 12 and a half hour blocks, and there's tons and tons of them. So with that being the structure of auditing, anywhere along this line, the auditor or the case supervisor could be making mistakes. They could be directing the person to do something. The case supervisor could be directing the auditor to run a process that, I don't know, through some clerical error, was run wrong, or was never run at all, or has already been run, or skip processes, or you know, and there's an infinite number of things that could go wrong here between the auditor messing up reading his e-meter, messing up how he's running the process, messing up how he interacts with the pre-clear, right? I mean, auditors are people too, right? They commit errors all the time. They don't, you know, answer the guy. They think the meter said one thing when it says something else, right? And this is, of course, all granting that the e-meter works, which it doesn't. But within the world of Scientology, if a process is run, it's supposed to be run because the meter needle is moving in a particular way. It's reading in response to that process. And they video these things. So the case supervisor might watch the video and go, dude, that process was not reading. It was not responding. Why did you run it? And so now the auditor has committed an error on the case. Well, any of these infinite number of errors, if you think about how everything I've said so far, you can see how there could be multiple opportunities for error. Any error that's committed on the case will need to be repaired, will need to be fixed, especially when pre-clears get sick, have accidents, get upset, start manifesting that they don't want to continue with their auditing, either by not paying for any more of it or having so many problems in their life that they say they can't. Because Scientology is supposed to be making you better, right? Scientology is supposed to be making you more able, able to make more money, more able to have opportunities to get more auditing. That's the whole concept of auditing. So if that's not happening, the Scientologist, the case supervisor, and the auditor will consider that they've done something wrong with the case and they'll want to fix it. But remember that at its fundamental level, at its like most fundamental, it's all about money. So that auditing repair, or what's called a review in Scientology, is never going to be for free, or very, very rarely, sometimes, but very rarely. So most of the time, they charge the person for it. And there's a whole litany of things that are done in Scientology, whole procedures that are done to review the auditing folders and list out all the errors on the case and write them all down on these pink pieces of paper. And this is called a folder error summary. And they actually summarize all the errors on the case. And this will, so if you have Auditor Joe, who's been auditing the pre-clear for, you know, hundreds of hours, or even 50 hours or 10 hours or however much he's been auditing them, a different auditor will sit down with the folder. Hardly ever will it be the same auditor. It could be, but usually it's a different auditor who's more objective, right? And goes through the folder and goes through all the worksheets and goes through everything that's there and writes down all the errors that happened, right? Whether the guy misran the process or whether the meter wasn't reading or whether the guy got sick or all this stuff is noted. And then the case supervisor looks at the folder error summary and writes out a review program to run on the pre-clear, which he has to pay for, in order to get him fixed up so that he can continue with his auditing on the grade chart, on the normal course, right? So you can consider a review sort of being parked off the side of the main highway and you're getting your tire changed. You know, that's basically what it comes down to, or you're getting your oil changed, or you're getting, you know, the transmission repaired or something, depending on, you know, it could be a very extensive review or it could be a quick patch up, right? Depends on the nature of the errors that were committed and how much review is necessary to fix it. And so this happens all the time. And like all the time. And pre-clears are made to pay for it. And so this not only wastes time and money as far as the pre-clear is concerned, because he's kind of like, fuck, you know, but the organization, right, ostensibly is doing it for the person's good, but considering the fact that auditing in general is really not doing what it says it's doing, and it's not really beneficial to a person in the long run, any more than, you know, going out for a walk every day and getting some air. That's beneficial, sure. You know, lots of things are beneficial to people. So I don't put any stock in auditing. So really, the whole thing is just a big waste. But in Scientology, this is the mainline activity. And so people spend thousands and thousands of dollars just to run up the main highway to get on up to OT, you know, sort of if you can imagine a road going up a mountain and at the top is total freedom, then they'll pay thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of dollars to get to the top of that road. But every time they get parked off to the side, they got to pay for the tow truck guy to come out and give them a repair, right? And that's review auditing. So long answer. Pretty simple concept, really, but I wanted to explain it thoroughly so you'd kind of get the whole picture of what that's all about. Because, as you said, you're a never-in, so I'm not assuming that you know really much of anything about all of this. So that's how it works. Marianne, I heard someone liken third-wave feminism to a cult that unduly influences its adherents in a similar manner as Scientology, the People's Temple, or the Unification Church. As a second-wave feminist myself, I tend to shy away from third-wave feminism because I think some of its causes are less about equality than they are about dogma. But I'm thinking the cult label might be a bit much. Your thoughts? Hey, thanks for the question, Marianne. And yeah, I actually agree with you. For the most part, I don't think that just because any group or subgroup has a kind of a wild-ass dogma or is very dogmatic or is very like, that makes them a cult. It's a little bit more complicated than that, right? There's a little bit more to it, I should say. I believe that there are subgroups within feminism that act like destructive cults. I believe that there are women within feminism who have, you know, certain traits that are very cult leader-like, and the people who follow them get into a very extremist state of mind about feminism and about equal rights, where they get into a frame of mind where their rights are, it's sort of like Animal Farm, you know, what's the line? Some pigs are a little bit are more equal than others, right? And that's the line from the book. I'm not saying women are pigs. But it's this idea that, you know, my equality trumps your equality, or they take it to this extremism, and that's where I have a problem with third and I think even fourth wave feminism. I think feminism accomplished much of its goals in all the years through suffrage and through civil rights and through the 70s and pay and all these kind of things. And do we still have, you know, progress left to be made? Of course we do. Absolutely. We're not all on a level playing field yet across the boards, and there's always going to be work to do on that. But as a social movement, I think it's accomplished a lot of things. And I think that a lot of those accomplishments get sort of, naysayed or looked at as though they're not important or something by current feminists who, you know, I think have a mindset that it's that too much is never enough. And they're never, and until they're the ones oppressing men, they're not really going to be satisfied. And I don't agree with that, right? I am all about equality, level playing field, tolerance, understanding, and also recognizing and realizing the fact that we're all never going to agree ever on everything or much of anything. We're just too, you know, human beings are just way too individualistic for that. And so it's going to be a constant, you know, the social norms and the social laws and the way we all get along and stuff need to be moved forward and constantly be worked on so that there is a recognition that all of us should be appreciated and understood for who and what we are, and that we should have equality under the law, right, when it comes to legal matters and whatnot. And because we're humans, the people who the laws might all say we're equal, but the people who are carrying out those laws might not necessarily agree, or they might make mistakes along the way, and so we have to fix those things. And so that's kind of, you know, how I look at that stuff. And I think that there are some people who have had injustices against them in their life. They have had things, bad things happen to them. And as a result, they go to an extreme to fight back against those injustices. And it's not good when that happens. It's bad for them that happened to them in the first place. It sucks. It's not fair. Life is not fair. But to then take that and move forward in such a way as to, well, now I'm going to take away other people's rights because mine were taken away in this instance, that's not a correct approach. And I think that that is the approach of some third wave feminists. And I think that's a mistake. So that's my take on that. Anne Farward. Hi, I really like what you are doing. Watching your videos helped me to get back to myself after I stopped coming to the Church of Scientology when I was still considered to be a member of the church and to stop feeling guilty. So now, when I'm free from Scientology, there are still some questions bothering me. I wonder why the practice of Dianetics and auditing couldn't be included as one of the programs to get better, as a possible remedy for psychology, neurology, psychiatry, etc., that would be fully or partially financed by the government funds, like, for example, obligatory health insurance that people have to pay with their tax, even if they are not working, even if they are never going to any doctors. I know that many doctors are bad because they prescribe only the most expensive pills for which they get secretly rewarded from the pharmacy companies, and these drugs may actually do more damage than help. I would like to hear your opinion about this. Thank you. Hey, Anne. First off, I would like to say that, well done for getting out of Scientology, and thank you very much. I'm really glad that my videos could help you. I'd like to say that I would really encourage you to keep educating yourself, because I think from some of the things you've said in your question that there's still some CCHR, Citizens Commission on Human Rights, and Scientology dogma going on in your head, and it's not that... It's not that Big Pharma are a bunch of good guys, okay? It's not that CCHR gets it wrong on everything, because they don't. There are definitely abuses in psychiatry. There are definitely overprescriptions occurring with pharmaceuticals. And there are definitely problems in that area. No question about it. But the idea that every doctor is prescribing medications because they're getting kickbacks from Big Pharma is that's not a truly accurate picture of what's going on, okay? So that all being said, I would just encourage you to keep finding out for yourself what the picture is out here in the big wide world of medicine and neurology and psychiatry and psychology. And I know that these are difficult topics to delve into with a Scientology background, because there's such heavy indoctrination in Scientology against anything that has to do with the brain or medicine or psychiatry and psychology specifically. And yet, the truth of the matter is that there are some very good people who have done some amazing work. I mean amazing work with neurology and with psychiatry and with psychology. There's some really great stuff out there to be learned and known about these fields that really explains a lot about the Scientology mindset, about cult mindsets, and about just how human beings operate, how we act, and why we act the way we do. So, heavily encourage education in that direction. Now, to answer your question about why, you know, do I think that, you know, why would the practice of Dianetics not be included in these fields? Well, see, it kind of is, but it's not called Dianetics or Scientology, of course. And I say it kind of is because Hubbard was taking things from psychology and psychiatry and incorporating them into Scientology. And I talk about Dianetics being a form of limited regression therapy, for example. Hubbard didn't invent the idea of going back and re-experiencing trauma or traumatic incidents that you've had in your past and going through them over and over again to desensitize them. And there have been studies done that show that that's actually not a very good thing to do, and it's not very effective at desensitizing traumatic experiences. But there's other studies that show that maybe, you know, I can't cite positive studies about it, but I do know that some people have benefited from it. Let me put it that way. So I'm not going to sit here and naysay basic, you know, regression therapy or the idea of going back over things that have happened in the past and, you know, talking about them. I think that can be helpful. You know, I think communication about life and things that have happened to us, I think that's always a helpful thing to do. So I don't have a problem with any of that as such. Dianetics takes that into this structured methodology and says, this is the only way to do it on every single person. This is universally workable. Everyone will respond. There are no exceptions to this, and that's where I call bullshit, because there are exceptions to it. There are people who don't respond to it, and the procedure itself is not at all scientifically validated through clinical trials and case studies and whatnot, that it is universally effective, right? Which is why in 1950, psychology and psychiatry looked at Dianetics and were like, yeah, no, this is pop psychology at its worst. And Hubbard was like, no, this is scientifically validated research, and this is absolutely universally workable, and you guys in psychology don't know what you're talking about. No, I'm sorry. Hubbard was the one who didn't know what he was talking about, and he was doing it, you know, to make the old greenbacks. So that is why I think you don't find people taking Dianetics into the secular world and using it universally as some, you know, magical way of healing the world. You know, it's been noted that you don't see fortune tellers winning the lottery. You don't see faith healers going into hospitals and emptying them out. Why not? Right? If fortune telling is a thing, then why has no fortune teller ever won the lottery? If faith healing is a thing, then why don't these people go into places where there is real physical need of healing and do something about it? It's because they can't, because it's fake. And so why is it that if Dianetics is so wonderful and is able to cure cancer, leukemia, bad eyesight, any physical derangement or problem, which is what Hubbard claims it will do, then why aren't the Scientologists going into hospitals or going down to medical centers or any area where there is a need for healing and doing it? Well, obviously for the same reason, because it doesn't do that. And so, you know, it doesn't live up to its claims. What it does is it makes some people feel better. It makes some people able to more easily look at traumatic incidents that have happened in their past. And that's it. That's all it does. And there are some people who have been in Scientology and in Dianetics who have come out of Dianetics and Scientology because they realized how bad it was, but they still feel good about what the Dianetics did for them, and so they still attribute all its workability to Hubbard and to Dianetics. And it's a mistake. It's just they're misinformed. And it's so frustrating, you know, for me to see that and see people still claim how wonderful Dianetics and Scientology are, even after they get out of the totalitarian organization of it and still claim that the technology is so wonderful. Because they, you know, for the most part, have no clue what the hell they're talking about. So anyway, that's my take on that. Larnaca LCA. Hi, Chris. You've stated on many occasions you are a sci-fi fan. Me too. My favorite movie director of all time is Kubrick. I am wondering, what's your take on his alleged involvement with NASA and Apollo missions? I would really like to pick your brain and critical thinking on the whole landing on the moon subject. I'm also wondering about Scientology's take on cosmology, apart from thetans, volcanoes, and the rest of the crazy. Thanks for your kind reply. You rock. Well, thank you, and I hope I got your name right. I don't know if I'm reading that right at all. Okay, so Kubrick and the moon landing. Yeah, I think that's conspiratorial nonsense. I literally think that's just made up. It's so farcical that it just comes off like a Monty Python skit. I mean, that they one, didn't land on the moon, that the whole thing was a fake. Two, that they then brought in Stanley Kubrick to direct it, I guess because somebody thought of this, because Kubrick was making 2001 A Space Odyssey at the time of the moon landing. And the idea that they've pulled this over on everyone, right? That this whole conspiracy happened and no one ever knew, right? And actually there's a great movie that was just made called Operation Freakout, which is not a super high budget movie. I saw it in an indie theater here a couple weeks ago. And it's about the CIA pulling off a fake moon landing and doing it in such a way that really only a few people knew. But of course the astronauts had to know. And you know, when you start talking about conspiracies like this, like real world conspiracies, not movies and not goofy ideas that float around on the internet, but real world activities like this, you're talking about involving so many people that the sheer number of them make it impossible to keep the thing a secret. It's the same thing as, this is the basic logic behind why I believe the whole 9/11 truther thing is just all a bunch of crap, is because the number of people who would have to be involved to fake something like, you know, the world trade, not fake, but to create a situation or a scenario where the World Trade Center was brought down, right? Or, you know, where we landed on the moon. We're talking about hundreds of people, you know, not a couple, not tens, we're talking hundreds. And it just grows and grows and grows. And none of those people ever came forward. All of them were killed by the CIA. I mean, it just gets ridiculous. You know, this sort of mindset becomes such a paranoid mindset that I can't go there. I just can't get into that, right? We have enough real world conspiracies and real world problems that really should be taking up our time and attention, that these fake things just become annoying. Now, as far as Scientology cosmology, since you kind of have a two-part question here, there's a lot to it. Hubbard talked a lot about what goes on up in space and in the universe, the big broad universe, and I've mentioned bits and pieces of it in earlier Q&As. And I can't explain the entire thing to you, but it involves things like the Markabian Galactic Confederation, okay, of which Xenu was the ruler. But there's more to it than just Xenu. There's this whole, you know, there's the whole big wide universe, right? Hubbard talks about the fact that magic existed at one time, way, way, way back, you know, many, 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 many years ago. Not here on Earth. We're talking all of this stuff preceding Earth, right? He talks about invader forces. He talks about the fact that this planet and this solar system was a jumping point to other galaxies, that because we're out on the rim of our galaxy, this was a place where ships would come and jump off to other places. And so this was a popular place to be. And so you had various invader forces, and they didn't all look like humans. He talks about the fact that some of them looked like big bugs and had big claw hands and these kinds of things, right? I mean, he's just throwing this stuff out left, right, and center, here and there. And it's never painted as a consistent cosmology, which is a point I've made before, is he just throws these things out there. And he talks about implant stations and places where, you know, out in the big wide galaxy, they kind of know that there is a spiritual existence. It's not just, you know, body, 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 and everybody's trapped in this endless cycle of body, 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 like they are here on Earth. He talks about Earth as a prison planet or a dumping ground, where kind of a similar way to the old movie Escape from New York, where New York, you know, Manhattan Island became prison and people just got dumped in there. And they just built walls around it and they just threw people in. And they just put guards on the walls and that was it. And the prisoners created their own society. Hubbard, the analogy he gives for Earth is very much like that, is people are just thrown here who were rebels or who were criminals or who were, you know, antagonists to the society, and they just threw them here. And this is what Earth consists of, is a bunch of people who are, you know, rebels and criminals. So those are bits and pieces of the cosmology. I wish I could lay it all out for you, but it would take hours because there's a lot of details. There's a lot of little things. And also there's so many inconsistencies and things that he just threw out and then he never explained anything more about them. So they just kind of leave you hanging. But he really showed, one thing I will say about Hubbard is he really showed that he was a sci-fi author, because all this stuff is just pure imagination. And I was intrigued and fascinated by it for years because I took it all as literal truth. Oh, Chris. So, there you go. Whoa, it is time for Flash Answers. Benjamin Johnson, here's a flash question for you that is non-Scientology and non-political. Who had the stronger interspecies bromance, Kirk and Spock or Han and Chewie? Oh, dude, Kirk and Spock all the way. I mean, like, absolutely. Those guys were awesomely connected. And, of course, it's kind of a threesome because you have to throw McCoy into it as well. But as far as bromance, yes, absolutely Kirk and Spock. Han and Chewie, awesome coupling. Definitely, you know, good, amazingly good friends, tight as hell. But I think that that Kirk and Spock was the senior of the two comparisons there. Cassie W., are you married or did you ever have children? Did being a Sea Org member factor into your decisions for your personal relationships? I apologize, I realize this is personal and hope it's not offensive. I have a really inquisitive nature. Yeah, no problem. You can ask me anything you want. I was married when I was in the Sea Org. I am not now. I divorced my wife when I left the Sea Org. And she's still there, and I'm here. And I do have a son. And I've mentioned him before in an earlier episode when I was pimping one of his videos. He's a filmmaker also. He lives down in Australia, which is where he was raised. I was not involved with raising him. But that's where he lives, and he's a great guy, and I am in touch with him. And as far as this being in the Sea Org factoring into my relationship decisions, kind of has to when you're in the Sea Org, because you can only hook up with other Sea Org members, and you can only hook up with them after you get married. So it kind of puts some big, you know, stipulations on you as to what you can and can't do. Now that I'm out of the Sea Org, I am not married, I have a girlfriend, and life is great. Mojo Ryzen, do you think that David Miscavige, or an assigned goon, watches all the videos and or reads all the literature put out there by guys like you and Tony Ortega? They obviously know when to launch their smear campaigns, so someone is keeping them in the loop, but to what extent do you think Miscavige goes to? Thanks, Chris. Absolutely. I don't think that David Miscavige personally is watching all this. I don't think he has the time for that. But I do, because there's a lot of it. But I'm absolutely positive Miscavige has watched Going Clear. I'm absolutely positive Miscavige has read the St. Pete Times articles. And I'm pretty sure Miscavige is well aware of Tony Ortega and what Tony Ortega does, whether he reads his blog on a daily basis or not. I doubt that David Miscavige has watched my videos. I think the Office of Special Affairs has. And I think they probably have a great big file on me. In fact, I'm positive they do, just like they have a great big file on all the church critics. and they keep up with our work so as to watch for any threats to what they consider threats to, you know, because they have to keep track of this stuff and put out fires when they feel it's necessary. Okay, so that is the end of our show this week. I hope that this was educational, informative, and entertaining. I am wide open to any and all questions you have for me, so go ahead and throw them in the comment section of my Q&A videos, and I will get to them. I've got a long list of questions to answer. Some of these questions I take up even months after the fact, and I'm sorry for the delay in this. It is impossible to keep up with how many questions I actually get. But I would like more, okay? Because some of the questions I get are duplicative. In fact, many of them are. Or they're questions that I've already answered. And I'm trying to not answer the same questions over and over again because that's not interesting for me or for you. So throw them at me and I will pick them up as fast as I can. And also consider throwing me some love through Patreon. I have a wonderful Patreon campaign going and I've got some brilliant support happening on that. But I honestly, I need more. And I only say that because I'm being bluntly honest, that in order for me to continue doing this channel in the way that I'm doing it and to continue offering the highest quality content that I can, I really want to make a go with this thing, and that's not just all Scientology related material either. As you've seen, I've been working on other content as well, and I think this channel is moving in exactly the right direction, but it happens with your support. So just wanted to throw that out there. All right, guys, thanks for coming around, and I will see you next week. Bye-bye.